You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary with you. Time now to introduce for the first of our roundups of the year's events, Tom Roberts from the National Catholic Reporter in the United States. Tom, good to have you with us again.
Always a pleasure, John.
It seems only briefly that we did talk to you a little time ago, the elections and Obama's victory. Things are spilling out in all sorts of ways. You see turmoil in the Republican Party, and the US Bishops Conference made some particularly forceful interventions during the election campaign, most of them anti-Obama and anti-Democrat. Are they now beginning to feel the blowback?
Well, I think so. The Republicans woke up on that Wednesday morning after the election and realized that if they're going to win an election, you know, in the next 50 years, they have to figure out how to go after the sort of the new power block, which is essentially the Browning of America. How do you get Hispanics and women? They lost both of those in large measure, and I think that the bishops woke up and saw that their interventions didn't work. Obama won the Catholic vote by, I think, 2 or 3 points, and he won Hispanics by 74% of them, I think. So that there's and most of those, you know, the Hispanics are very largely Catholic. They're certainly not listening to the bishops. They're voting their own interests, in this case, you know, immigration reform.
And on the specific issues, too, that the bishops advocated, the contraception stuff, the same-sex marriage stuff, they didn't do too well there either, did they?
You know, they preceded the election around the religious liberty issue, the campaign, which most outside of the conference saw as really a complete bust. And then they spent millions campaigning in 4 states, 3 of which had votes on the ballot about same-sex marriage, you know, approving or disapproving. And same-sex marriage won in all 3 of those states. And then there was a 4th state that the vote was whether there would be an amendment to the state constitution defining marriage as exclusively between a man and a woman. And that lost. So in all of these measures, the bishops come out losers in the national arena, and I think that they have to reassess how do you lead in the public square, how do you confront issues, and where's your authority? Who's listening to you?
When bishops lose a general vote, one can argue that, oh, well, you know, the public just aren't in tune with us. But when they begin to lose the Catholic vote, there's a serious question there about how the church places itself in the society, that the way the church, in fact, deals with the world becomes an issue there if you're not carrying your own people with you.
Well, precisely, and it comes out in very strong relief when in specific states, the bishop is the prime public figure. For example, in the same-sex marriage battles, the prime public figure addressing the issue and trying to get support for it, spending enormous amounts of money on it, and they lose.
The bishops are appointed with a strong influence from Rome over the years. We've seen, particularly under John Paul II and Benedict, a deliberate and intentional move towards a more conservative group in the bishops' conference. Are their voices now saying, look, this has been an unfortunate direction, or is it the other view, that is, we must maintain this rigid position at all costs?
Well, publicly, there was a bishops' meeting in November shortly after the election where all the bishops in the United States gathered in Baltimore, and the language there was, you know, it was a sad day for marriage, and we're going to double down on this matter of marriage, and we're going to double down on these other issues that were so important to us we can't compromise. But we know from speaking to other bishops, there's a real rift in that conference. There are some people who are really not only disappointed but angry at the sort of partisan nature of these initiatives, and they now can say, they can bring to the table, look, this isn't working, and we're losing our status in the culture, we're losing credibility, they were not persuading anybody. And I think there is that concern that they're just sort of marginalizing themselves, and there's a real concern in the conference that that's happening.
Moving away from the elections, this is showing up in a couple of other areas. I mean, we particularly have the ongoing investigation of women religious in the United States, and most newspapers carried the nuns on the bus story during the election campaign of a group of nuns traveling the US advocating a more sort of socially concerned view against the investigators from the Vatican, saying, no, you've got to narrow your focus back to sort of traditional moral issues.
John, never in my memory have the nuns in the United States received so much good press. You know, in one sense, they ought to be sending thank you notes to the congregation that decided to investigate them, because all of a sudden, the people want to hear their story. And so they're out there on the stump being able to talk about what they do in a way that they've never been able to before and with an interest that they've never experienced before. They're giving talks and they're explaining themselves in a way that they've never been able to before, because no one really wanted to, you know, you took nuns for granted. One of the things that's coming across, first of all, is that the sisters in the United States, when they took seriously the call to renewal and to look at their roots, went out and got educated. So you have some really well-educated women in this universe. I mean, we're talking about doctors and lawyers and, you know, other kinds of professionals with business degrees and things that, you know, are not traditional in the convent. And the second thing is that everybody, every Catholic in the pew, and even disaffected Catholics, know nuns. They have aunts who are nuns and sisters and, you know, cousins and all the rest of it, and they've known nuns to do some really good things. Almost nobody, I mean, very, very few Catholics personally know a bishop. So when it becomes bishops versus nuns, and this is purely on a public relations level, there's a great deal of sympathy on the ground already for the women who are being disciplined or questioned by a group of men. And right or wrong, there's an immediate sympathy there. But I think that what we're seeing is the sisters are not rushing to do anything to accommodate the Vatican charges and accusations. In the last press release, they met with the three bishops who were on the committee to investigate them at the bishops' meeting in Baltimore, and the release that came out afterwards from both sides was very curt. It was simply, these were amiable discussions, and they agreed to discuss some more.
What's the scuttlebutt about where this is going?
The scuttlebutt that, you know, you hear it both ways, but I think the greater opinion is that the bishops realize that this is a lose-lose situation and that it will quietly go the way of the investigation of the general orders, which, you know, is on a shelf somewhere in Rome, and I don't think we're going to hear a whole lot of anything out of it, or no one suspects there's going to be a great deal of discipline, but that's still to be played out.
Both of these stories, the way in which the focus of the church has been shifting, or the attempt to shift the focus of the church, play out, ironically, this year of all years, against the 50th anniversary of Vatican II, the great opening of the windows of the church onto the world. The irony has not escaped many commentators. How's that playing out?
Well, I think in a great many ways it's playing out. I mean, you know, all kinds of publications across the ideological spectrum, from conservative to liberal, are using this as a year to look at the documents and essentially spin the documents the way they think the council should go and the history of the church should go. But I think it's really interesting to note that something like the nuns on the bus could not have occurred without Vatican II. There is a growing realization, looking at this scope of the council's effects over, you know, 50 years, that things have changed rather dramatically from the memory of those of us who were going to grade school and high school during the council years, that the church is not like it was 50 years ago.
The genie is out of the bottle.
The genie's out of the bottle in so many ways, and part of it is necessity, too. And I've said this a number of times, you know, that often on the ground here, theology is meeting need, and need is meeting theology. And where there's a need, you can find a theology and do things differently, and that theology most often comes from the documents of Vatican II. What's the common wisdom? It takes 100 years for a council to be accepted. So we're halfway there, and I think the fact that it is being investigated and chewed over and looked at in such detail 50 years later is a sign that something important happened there. And then we're still trying to figure out what it means for us.
Tom Roberts, the sexual abuse crisis plays out in Australia over the past year. It's been running in the United States for several years. Of course, we've had the Irish story. But now in the United States, in the past 12 months, we've had a bishop actually confront the prospect of charge and imprisonment because of the way he behaved in response to the sexual abuse crisis. Can you just outline what's happened for us?
Yes, this was Bishop Robert Finn in Kansas City, Missouri, and he learned of a priest had had a computer with a lot of images of young girls on it, sexual images or images of that were really inappropriate. But he did nothing about it for, I think, 5 months. until he was forced to admit to police that he knew about this. In the meantime, he'd sent this priest, in violation of the, by the way, the bishop's charter that they'd put together in 2002, he'd sent this guy to a convent, essentially saying, stay out of the way of kids and be a good priest and repent. Of course, he didn't. There were a couple of other incidents, and people warned him, past the principal of the school, warned the bishop of her, you know, uneasy feelings about this guy. Finn was eventually arrested and charged with failing to report this priest. He was tried. He avoided prison. There was a plea deal, and they dropped some of the charges, and there were conditions placed on his being able to stay out of jail, and that involved being supervised essentially by civic authorities in his going around to parishes and certain requirements of talking to these parishes. But that's where it stands. So we have in Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese, a bishop who was charged and convicted of failing to report a priest who had been involved in essentially child pornography.
Two questions briefly out of that. One, what's his status now within the church and how is he treated as a bishop? And two, what's the public response?
The public response has been overwhelmingly, get him out of here. I mean, thousands of people in this diocese have signed petitions and sent letters, at least by the hundreds, to the papal nuncio. None of them, as far as I know, has received even a response to that. There's been public outcry and demonstrations in front of the chancery office. Most recently, we learned that a majority of priests surveyed, I think 40, and I don't know exactly how many are in the diocese, a majority of those questioned his ability to lead the diocese. There's been collection of the annual bishop's fund has been affected by this. And so there's a real state of tension in the diocese and uncertainty about what the future will be. The bishops did not address this in their recent meeting, but the observation, it was easy to see one day I was there, that he was basically a loner in the halls by himself. And behind the scenes, there was a great deal of conversation about how he could remain and why Rome wasn't moving against him.
Extraordinary. Let's finish up with the strange tale of the papal butler and where that's at.
Well, I think they're still are they still building the cell in Rome where they're going to hold this guy? I'm not intimately familiar with any details beyond the trial, but I think that the larger question is, okay, he may have lifted documents off of the Pope's desk and in that sense been culpable of a crime inside the Vatican. But the question is, was the larger point he was making, that there's a lot of corruption in the Vatican, true? I mean, can we get at that? We know that the papal nuncio to the United States was sent here because he sent a long letter to the Pope saying, there's a lot of corruption, and let me keep fixing it. You know, and he's bounced off the scene. I think this idea that secrets can remain in the papal palace in the 21st century, in this age of communication, that somehow you can use the word transparency but not be transparent as an organization, just isn't working.
Yes, the medieval court approach will no longer suffice.
Well, it won't, and I think that's in many ways what we're talking about. All these topics we're talking about somehow get back to that culture and the expectations of a culture that was able to keep to itself its own behavior and its own sort of expectations and presumptions and all the rest of it. And that isn't the case anymore. I mean, the sex abuse crisis helped to open that up a bit. But in many other ways, you know, finances and women and place of women in the church and how you respond to lay people and how you act in a culture, the royal model doesn't work anymore. And I think that everyone is sort of feeling that, but not knowing quite where to go with it and how to fix it.
Tom, thanks so much for looking at the past year for us on Sunday night.
Again, thank you for inviting me.